Yeah. I mean, why not?
So, okay. I'm like, okay, there's the recording. I see me down here. I don't see you in this video. Maybe sometime when we're not actually recording an episode, we can test this.
Do you want to test it first?
No. No. No, because it will screw up. We'll have to close out. I will have to restart my computer. That'll make it decide it needs to update.
And that'll take a year and a half.
And that'll take a year and a half, and we will not be recording today. So, because
see you
right
in 2022.
Now, I am super excited that I don't have a story today. And I'm like, oh, I can just like sit and zone out into something totally not related to adult things that I'm having to take care of in my life. So I'm so happy right now. We realized that when I was eating lunch, I was like, oh, I just get to chill for a couple of hours and not worry about anything.
Kristen is in the process of looking for a house to buy.
Yes.
If you don't want me to share that, I'll cut it.
No, I don't care. You can share it. I mean, maybe people can commiserate with me because I told somebody yesterday at work who bought a house last year, so he understands.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm Dana.
I'm Kristen.
Welcome to The Darker Side of Life.
Welcome back.
This is the podcast where two best friends tell each other strange, creepy, weird, unexplained, true crime, ghost, haunting stories. Anything that's kind of weird or strange. Maybe a little morbid, a little dark. But we don't tell each other what we're going to talk about. So 1 week, one of us will tell a story, and then the other person just listens.
And you have the story today.
I do.
Yay.
It takes place in Scotland.
Scotland. I love Scotland.
Do you?
I do.
Good. We're going to talk about the Great Mull Air Mystery.
Mull? Like you mull?
M-U-L-L.
Oh, I was like mole, like
oh, like a mole,
like
the creature. Oh, my accent doesn't affect the story.
Oh, this is going to be Scottish, so you're going to have a Scottish accent. I love Scottish accents.
I can't do accents. I cannot. It comes out Jamaican every time. I'm Joey Tribbiani on Friends.
The South will rise again, Mom.
That's totally me. I can't do accents.
I just had a conversation with a friend about accents, and he said he hates Scottish and Irish accents. And I'm like, I love Scottish and Irish accents on men. Like, love it. I don't know why. It's very attractive to me. But because he said it's very, like, rough. So I'm like, well, that makes sense. Like, I would be more attracted to, like, the rougher accent. So, yes, I love Scottish accents. Okay, so what is this called again?
It's the Great Mull Air Mystery.
Okay.
Sources. There are many. There's a podcast / radio series on BBC Radio 4 by Steve Punt. It's called Punt PI. And I don't like to listen to other podcasts about other stories that I'm doing, but this one has such good information. And it's only about like a half hour long. So if you guys do take an interest in the story, I highly suggest going in and listening to that because he actually goes to the place and talks to people involved, which is really, really cool. There's an article from The Independent out of the UK called The Riddle of the Lost Flight, a Reddit thread with a few, you know, what ifs and scenario speculations, an article from historicmysteries.com, an article from the Scottish Daily Mail, an article from the BBC, a blog post from a search and rescue member. His username is heavywally.mbe. He's a mountain rescue specialist, environmentalist, and spent a lot of time with the Royal Air Force Mountain Rescue. And finally, our artist friend, David from Scotland, who has been interacting with us on Instagram some.
Yay! Hi, David.
We have kind of been messaging back and forth without you on my own Instagram page talking about this.
Not fair.
And so I'm going to kind of note him as a part contributor to this story because he really helped me out here that I'm going to tell you about later on.
Sweet.
There were two books that I wanted to find about this, but I guess they're out of print. And I could not find them anywhere. And that's what prompted me to message David to begin with, because I thought maybe he could find them in Scotland and I could buy them from there. But he didn't have any luck either. So, but he did find out something else for me that I will talk about later in this episode.
Primary sources.
Yeah.
Well, kind of primary, secondary.
Sort of. Yeah. Sort of. So this mystery begins with a pilot named Peter Gibbs. He was born in 1921, and he's often described as being a rather impetuous type of person. Like, maybe he not so much a hothead, but he's the kind of person that maybe kind of acts before he thinks and maybe strikes some kind of balance between won't take no for an answer and I do what I want. You know, the only person in control of him is him, basically. I mean, they don't always have to be taken as bad qualities in a person because there's something to be said for perseverance and determination that a person can have.
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, he piloted a Spitfire with the number 41 Squadron of the Royal Air Force, and he ended up shooting down at least four German flying bombs, is what they called them then, in Normandy. They're kind of like drones, I guess, because they were unmanned like bombs that were just designed to explode on impact.
Okay.
So he saw some action, and he's pretty good. His son Michael said on the Punt PI podcast that at one point, probably after the war, I don't know if this was during or after the war, he was in an accident of some kind where he spent 3 months in the hospital and they had to glue part of his kneecaps back together somehow.
Ow.
Yeah. I'm not sure the exact nature of that accident or exactly when it happened, but Michael said he probably should have stopped flying after that, but he never did. He always liked to fly. He liked to fly low and fast, and he loved the adrenaline rush that he got from it, from being in a plane.
It's fun.
And he actually survived a plane crash in 1942, and in 1944, he survived having to bail out of a plane.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think I'd be done with flying after that.
It's amazing to me, too, that seeing so much action during World War II, he still wanted to fly.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, they're like, nope, I'm never getting in a plane again. Like, yeah. Some people are just done with it, but he was not. He was also known to be a pretty good musician in his civilian life, and he was known to be an excellent violinist. I have to tell this story. It's not really super relevant, but it's interesting. He formed his own string quartet, and he played in orchestras around the world. One notable story plays to his character of being this kind of impulsive person. In 1956, he was playing with the London Symphony Orchestra during a tour of the United States, and several members of the orchestra thought the conductor was behaving really unprofessional on the tour when he was conducting a lot of the smaller concerts in smaller cities. In Boston, the conductor just walked off the stage when he was done without acknowledging the audience, turning and bowing, acknowledging applause, anything.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't address anybody. He just left. And so Peter was pissed about this. So the next day during rehearsal, the conductor came in late and Peter immediately stood up and told him off. He looked at him and he goes, quote, I did not spend 4 years of my life fighting bastards like you to be insulted before our own allies as you did last evening.
Oh, gosh.
And the conductor was Austrian and he conducted the Philharmonic in Berlin for a long time.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Yeah.
Peter let him have it.
Mic drop.
Pretty much. Well, later that night, during the actual performance, the conductor refused to go back on stage until Peter was immediately fired.
What
and
a
so
little
the managers,
baby.
The managers were kind of forced into a position where they have to put on this concert. But Peter was kind of like, you can't fire me, I'll quit, kind of anyway.
Yeah.
So Peter left and the concert went on. But I don't think Peter lost any sleep over it.
Well, no, I wouldn't want to be directed by someone like that.
Also, his son Michael said that one time during a concert, he let loose a bag of live grasshoppers in the music hall. I don't know why, just to get a laugh.
Just because.
During all of this touring with the Philharmonic and all, he also dipped into property management and real estate, and he became the managing director of a company called Gibbs & Ray. He also kept flying, too. He joined the Surrey Flying Club in 1957. He kept his pilot's license active, and he had more than 2,000 hours of flying experience.
That's a lot.
One of his friends accepted an invitation to fly with him over this nature reserve in Scotland, but he regretted it when Peter began to navigate by just a little small handbook that he had with him. And he would occasionally swoop the plane down super low to read road signs to navigate.
Can you imagine? Like, you're just like driving along and all of a sudden it's playing like,
do
we
have to
sorry.
Turn left here? Hang on. Let me check. He's like dive bombing a stop sign.
Oh my God.
I don't think the friend flew with him anymore after that.
Traumatizing.
But you can get kind of an idea of how like maybe spontaneous and maybe impulsive he might be at times.
Mm-hmm.
His ex-wife once said that he crammed about four people's lives into his lifetime.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Can I live like that, please?
If you want to dive bomb road signs in a plane.
No,
I mean,
I would do it in other ways, but not that way.
On December 20th, 1975, Peter and his girlfriend Felicity took the ferry to the Isle of Mull, where he was supposedly interested in buying some investment property around there. They stayed at the Glenforsa Hotel on the east side of the island, which sits on the Sound of Mull, this waterway between the island and mainland Scotland. The Glenforsa Hotel stayed pretty busy back then. In the summer, it stayed light outside longer, so of course it was always busy in the summer season. But even during the winter, it would stay busy with the locals. David Howitt, who ran the hotel in 1975, said they kept it open in the winter months, and they always stayed busy with, you know, quizzes and events on the weekends, kind of like they do trivia nights at bars here. Mm-hmm. And the hotel had its own airfield. Of course, being a pilot, this made it even more attractive to Peter. On maps, it's called the Glenforsa Airfield. In real life, it is a grass landing strip.
There's your airfield.
It's a long, flat, very neatly mowed, and I think that it's got painted lines on it now. Mm-hmm. It's just a patch of grass where you can land small planes. And the airstrip was built in 1966. It was used primarily to be able to take patients to and from nearby hospitals by air ambulance. And today it's still pretty heavily used. They have like fly-ins and air shows and events and things. And pilots give tours of the area from there. So it's a pretty well-used airstrip even today. And it sits between the hotel and the water. So you have the Sound of Mull, you have an airstrip that's pretty much next to the water, and then you walk a little further, and then here's the hotel.
Okay.
And in 1975, it is pitch black at night. At the time, there was no runway lights, they didn't have reflectors, they didn't have anything to guide you at night. So
you just guess?
Flying at night, taking off and landing were illegal at the time.
Okay.
Peter had rented a small Cessna, and he and Felicity would fly around to some of the islands to inspect possible properties for investments. They got back to the Glenforsa Hotel, had Christmas Eve dinner and several drinks, and Peter decided he wanted to see if he could make a successful takeoff and landing at night at the airstrip.
Oh, no.
Everybody told him it couldn't be done. Not to Peter.
You don't tell that to somebody who has that kind of personality that something can't be done.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be like, yes, it can. Be like, it's illegal. You're not allowed to do it.
Don't care. I do what I want.
I do what I want.
Plus, being able to land and take off at night would be a huge benefit to whoever's owning that hotel.
Put some lights down. There you go. Problem solved.
Of course, everybody tried to tell him it was impossible, or, you know, it may have been possible, but he shouldn't go do it. Because some sources state a winter storm was coming in, but some weather records from 1975 say that there really wasn't a winter storm, but like kind of spots of heavy rain and sleet happening across the area at the time. But you still don't want to go out. It's cold, it's windy, it's sleeting, visibility's probably really bad, it's in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
I mentioned before, never mind that local ordinances prohibited night landings at the time. When anything to the contrary was pointed out to Peter, he simply said he was not asking for permission. And he told the owner, quote, I just thought it was courteous to let you know I don't want to fuss.
Like, I'm doing this anyway.
What can the owner do, though? I mean, physically restrain him to not take off? I mean, at some point, what responsibility do you have? You can tell somebody all day long not to do something, but in the end, they're going to make their own decision.
Yeah. You would hope that if it's illegal, they wouldn't do it because it's the law, but...
He gave two flashlights to Felicity and had her go down to the end of the runway to guide his takeoff and landing. So she could put a flashlight, like one on the left and one on the right, so he can kind of go in between and know where the end of the runway was. Mm-hmm. His plan was just to fly around a loop or two for about 5 minutes and then come back.
Okay.
At about 9:30 p.m., he had Felicity go place the flashlights to give him a point of reference, and he started up the Cessna. David Howitt was interviewed in the Punt PI podcast and said he and his wife were watching TV and heard an aircraft start up outside. They got some binoculars and went to the window and saw him, and he thought, what is that madman doing? David saw the plane take off, and he saw the landing lights on them like flash off and on again. I guess the aircraft lights, mm-hmm. and the plane disappeared into the night. Other witnesses described the takeoff as being flawless. They said it was textbook perfect. David and his wife ran to the upstairs bathroom because there was a window there to better see, and they wanted to watch the landing. They could see it from there. After about 10 minutes, David started to get worried, And a few more minutes later, the plane didn't come back. Mm-mm. And people were starting to get concerned. David said he feared that Peter had to ditch the plane in the water. So he took his car and drove it down to the water's edge and turned on his headlights. And he would just kind of kept driving it back and forth to kind of sweep the water to see if he could see anything. But the sleet was getting worse by now. He said there was no way you could see anything.
Mm-hmm.
Felicity is now super worried because he hasn't come back. At 10 o'clock, she leaves the airstrip and goes back to the hotel to tell somebody that Peter's missing. We need to call for help.
Uh-oh.
Local police are at the hotel by midnight. Way to spend... Merry Christmas.
2 hours.
Merry Christmas. Well, it's kind of a rural area and it's kind of out there, so...
Jeez.
There's only so much they could do in the weather. They could search the airstrip and see if there's anything that might have caused a problem. Like, was there something on the runway that he could have hit, you know? They didn't find anything initially, but their search was limited so much by the weather and everything. The next morning, the weather improved a little bit, so a formal search was conducted. It went on for a while after Christmas. I don't have an exact time frame, but I think it went on for a few weeks at least.
Oh, geez.
The search area was fairly large, as there were hundreds of people on the ground looking. The Royal Air Force and Navy Service also sent in manpower and equipment to help look, too. And the search and rescue worker from the blog, Heavy Wally, username, mentioned that in the days after Christmas, the snow and ice started getting kind of heavier and it wasn't the most ideal conditions anyway. And they searched almost this entire island and they didn't find anything, like nothing. Heavy Wally, I don't know if this is his real name, but that's the username. He recalls how they were put up in the Glenforsa Hotel during that time. And he said the hospitality was absolutely amazing and everybody was so friendly and helpful, but they were all really feeling down and out because as a search and rescue worker to search that long and hard for somebody, they found absolutely nothing. That's so weird. So they all like their spirits were just really like, it was really heavy on them to not be able to find anything. They didn't find a body. They didn't find the plane. They didn't find a scrap of the plane. They didn't find an article of clothing, nothing. Peter was just gone.
Did he just peace out?
Maybe.
They say, sorry, I'm leaving. Bye, Felicity.
On April 21st, 1976, about 4 months later, a local shepherd named Donald McKinnon was out about a mile from the Glenforsa Hotel, about 400 feet from the base of this hill, and he came across a man's body.
Oh, no.
He was an adult. He was wearing flying gear, and he was laying on his back, but he was slumped over a fallen tree.
Okay.
This hill was searched after the accident.
Ooh.
Surely somebody would have noticed a body laying there. Yeah. And it's not a forest, you know, it's a hillside. There's some pockets of trees in places, but for the most part, it's not a forest.
Weird.
And to be fair, though, and I know this isn't fun, to be fair.
We have to.
But my knowledge of this whole area comes from Google Maps and whatever I can see on Street View and Google Earth images.
Mm-hmm.
And it is more hilly and barren than foresty. And the hills aren't mountains. It's not like you have to like have a camelback and some extra water with you to like climb them or anything.
Right.
They're just hills. They don't take a lot of huge effort to get on top of. So taking into account that I don't know the exact terrain of this place, I still don't think, I don't think people would have overlooked a body.
And there wasn't snow on the ground that would cover him,
right? Not in April.
Okay.
I don't know.
Like before then.
It rains and snows off and on.
I just didn't know maybe if, because you said sleet.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like it was like a big snowstorm that would have like covered him up and it was just mist or something like that.
Even if it was just sleet, if they searched everything, they were there.
Sleet wouldn't do anything.
They started almost immediately.
Right.
What they could. And then when the weather cleared, then they all went out. It's not like they dumped like 5 or 6 feet of snow on the ground that day.
Right. Just sleet. And sleet's not going to...
No.
Rain. I mean, it's basically just rain.
So by now, you figured out that the body belongs to Peter Gibbs.
Yes. So he didn't peace out.
Right. And his body is in full view of anybody that just simply looks up in that direction. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't too far from the road. I don't know if you could see it from the road or not, because I don't know which hill it was found on.
Was there any wreckage around him? Like plane wreckage?
Negative.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he just crashed into this place.
Yeah. In the 4 months since Peter's disappearance, nobody reported seeing anything odd or suspicious or finding anything around the hills. And local shepherds and farmers were apparently on the hills all the time because they a lot of them raised sheep and other livestock. So they were mm-hmm. all around the area. Peter had no parachute on. There was no sign of the plane or wreckage nearby. He didn't even have a harness for a parachute. And although his body was like standard decomposition to be out in the elements for 4 months, mm-hmm. his only injury appeared to be a small cut on his right leg.
A lot less than what you would expect in a plane crash.
Yeah. Donald mm-hmm. McKinnon, who found him, was interviewed on Punt PI, and he details the condition in which he found the body. He said his head was facing downhill and his feet were uphill, so he was kind of upside down a little. He was facing mm-hmm. north. To him, he said it appeared as if he were higher up on the hill and maybe stumbled and fell, and that's how he ended up in the position over the tree log.
Mm-hmm.
He also tells a really weird story that he said he's never told anybody until he did the interview with Steve Punt. It's really strange. He said a few years later, a former girlfriend of Peter's asked him to show her where his body was found. FYI, we do not know if this is Felicity or not. He just says a former girlfriend. He'd been married once before, we know, so I'm just putting that out there. Donald said that around where his head was laying, his scalp was sort of detached from his skull a little bit. But, you know, there's decomposition and you've been out in the elements for 4 months. The girlfriend took out a plastic bag and she started collecting things from around that spot and took the bag with her when she left.
Weird.
I don't know why. I don't know why. You do you, girl.
Okay. Well, no judging. Just yeah. weird. Like, so just like dirt and sticks and stuff?
I guess. I mean, there's nothing there. His body wasn't there anymore. It's not like he had clothing or
anything. I don't know. I've stopped trying to rationalize people at this point in this world. So
the discovery of Peter's body raised even more questions. Nobody seemed to know how he ended up there or where the plane was.
Yeah.
Further, it was discovered that Peter's pilot's license had expired in October of 1974 because his medical certification had lapsed and he never upped it. So whoever rented the plane to him obviously didn't check to see his license, which is a huge deal to me because in the United States, you can't rent a car or anything without having a driver's license.
Oh my God.
And proof of insurance. You have to be 25 or older. You need a blood sample and your firstborn.
Yes, I mean, there you go. Yep, pretty much.
We have pretty strict rules. So you can just go get a plane. It's like, hey, I'm a pilot. Can I use your plane? Sure.
It is the 70s. I mean, things were a little more laxed, I think. At least here in the States, I feel like they were more lax, like 70s, 80s.
And maybe
different world.
Maybe they have different rules there than we have here. I don't know. But either way, I don't know if the guy would have rented him the plane if he was like, your license is expired, dude. I can't do this to you.
Maybe it was like, hey, your license is expired, like it just did last year. And it was kind of like, hey, come on, like work with me a little.
You know, obviously he doesn't get the plane back because it's gone. But
it's gone.
I wonder how he could explain that to an insurance company. Like I rented a plane, the guy crashed and died. Can I get reimbursed for my plane? And if he didn't have a pilot's license, I bet in the United States, the insurance company 100% would deny your claim. Right.
I mean, either way, it's like, you either didn't check it, which is bad, mm-hmm. or you let it slide, which is bad.
Yeah.
So either way, you're just kind of screwed.
But, you know, if he would have said no, he probably would have kept Peter from flying that night.
Yeah. Yes.
Because he would have had access to a plane.
Yeah, it's true.
But also, just because his license is a few months expired, well, almost a year, but it doesn't mean he doesn't know how to fly a plane. It's just not on paper.
Well, I mean, our driver's license expire. It doesn't mean suddenly we have no idea what we're doing.
David Howitt said he heard Peter tell the plane's owner that he just didn't bring his license because he didn't expect to be flying. But if he's there to scout properties for real estate investments and he was a pilot, I feel like flying is one of the best ways that you do that. You cover a lot of ground faster that way.
Yeah.
I think Peter fibbed a little bit when he said
Probably.
That. Steve Punt interviewed the forensic pathologist who looked at Peter's body after it was found, and the Scottish National Archives sent him a copy of the fatal accident inquiry from 1976. This information creates more mysteries.
Okay.
Number one, there's no major injuries to Peter's body. We already mentioned the cut on his right leg, which could be from anywhere. But after the forensic investigators were finished, they found no signs of bad injuries. No broken bones, no bad bruising, no blood hemorrhaging, nothing to suggest that he had jumped from a flying plane or had crashed in one.
Right.
Investigators also determined that Peter's body must have been there all along because they found no evidence that it had been moved or placed there by somebody else.
Okay.
After the crash, people began to speculate that Peter must have crashed into the water somehow, swam to shore, and he got lost and ended up on top of this hill. However, scientists found no traces of saltwater or marine organisms anywhere on his clothing or his body. Nothing in like folds, nothing in pockets, under his fingernails. Nothing. Like on the microscopic level, there's nothing.
Mm-hmm. He'd also been out in the elements though for a while.
Right. The forensic pathologist said that absent any other evidence, they determined that he had died from exposure, likely hypothermia, which makes sense. Toxicology reports also came back clear, even though he'd been drinking a lot during the big Christmas Eve dinner. I mean, 4 months later, it probably is gone.
How big is this island?
It's kind of big.
I just don't know how somebody gets lost on an island.
Well, it's also close to the mainland, too, because the Sound of Mull is kind of like a river here, like a big river, like the Mississippi, I guess, that just kind of connects.
Mm-hmm.
The Isle of Mull covers 875 square kilometers. It's the fourth largest Scottish island.
Okay.
So it's pretty big.
I don't know kilometers, so.
543 miles.
Okay.
So driving from Atlanta to South Florida.
I know it by hours, so I have no idea.
Me too.
It took me 4 hours to get there.
Four hours?
Holy crap. Sorry, it was eight. No, I was thinking from Atlanta to Kentucky would take me eight. So I was like, four. I'm like, oh no. It took us four to get out of Florida. 8 hours. Yes, because when we drove together, we split it. I drove four, you drove four.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so 8 hours. So, okay.
You're not speeding through Georgia. Those cops will get you.
Heck no. I hit the Georgia line and it was like, I am going the speed limit, not one over.
Some people begin to think that Peter had to bail out from the plane somehow, but we mentioned before that no parachute was found. He wasn't wearing a harness for one. And Alan Organ, who's an author who wrote one of the books that I tried to find, but I couldn't, he was interviewed by Steve Punt, and he mentioned that parachutes in 1975 were kind of big and bulky, and you probably wouldn't fit into the seat of a Cessna with one, like the kind of plane that Peter had, because it would be so big and bulky and strapped to your back, it would force you to sit too close to the controls of the plane, so you'd be kind of smushed up there in the cockpit.
Okay.
Also, if you jump from a plane at, you know, more than so many feet, you're going to hurt yourself upon landing.
Right.
Probably more so than just a cut on knee.
Right.
And if you jump from any extreme height, you're going to have broken bones and stuff. Mm-hmm. If you jump from a small height, then the plane is like a few feet off the ground. It's going to be there. Like, where's it going to go? It's not going to fly on its own 10 feet above the ground. One Redditor who was a pilot mentioned that he could have jumped from the plane if he felt he was in trouble. And depending on the controls of the plane, like how he has the flap set and the speed and whatnot, and what the wind conditions and stuff were at the time, it's a very slight possibility, but there is a possibility that he could have jumped from the plane at a low altitude and the wind could have carried the plane off and like out to sea if these winds were really bad and all the conditions had just had to be right.
Right.
But after the body's discovery, crews went out again to search for the plane. And they didn't find it.
Where's the plane? This is like Amelia Earhart, but we have the body.
In October of 1976, a few months after Peter's body was found, a local man found a wheel that appeared to be from a small plane on the shore, not too far from the Glenforsa Hotel.
Did I say far?
I did.
I wasn't going to say anything. But I'm like, I maybe need
I'm
to.
Glad you did because I'm sure listeners are just like all raising a collective eyebrow. Like, what did she say?
Flar.
Flar. Okay.
And we realized it at the exact same time.
I feel so connected to our listeners right now.
I know. They laugh with us and probably at us.
I accept all of those. The article from the Scottish Daily Mail mentions that the tire was, quote, consistent with violent sideways impact, an aircraft at speed smashing and somersaulting into the sea. People were certain that the wheel came from Peter's plane. I don't know how they know this for a fact, but how many planes are in this water right now? Probably not a lot.
Yeah, yeah. But again, like, he would have had to have been out of the plane at that point, because if a plane is somersaulting, he's going to have serious injuries.
And small planes are not going to hold up well.
No.
In 1986, this is a decade later, two brothers were out diving for clams in the area, and about 100 feet of water, they came across the wreckage of a small plane. Mm. It was red and white, which matched the colors of the Cessna that Peter was in, and they noticed the number on the side, GAVTN, which was the exact plane that Peter was in.
Oh.
The Scottish Daily Mail said they tried to take some photos of it, but the water was really murky and they basically just didn't come out well. And I mean, underwater photography in the 70s is probably not the best.
But this is the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they said the wings were both missing. There was a big hole in the windshield and they were unable to open the doors. They may have been locked or latched shut somehow. One of the wheels was missing, which would add credibility to the wheel that was found in 1976. A short distance later, they found the engine of the plane totally separate from the fuselage.
Good Lord.
This indicates a pretty violent crash into the water. This plane is pretty much broken apart. There was no body inside. There was no evidence of one having been there, but they did say that inside was a pretty big lobster.
Chilling.
Lobster's like, this is my house.
My new
now.
Home.
Free real estate. Another crew was sent out to try to find the plane again, but they were never able to relocate that site.
Oh, so they found it and then couldn't find it again.
It's like we find it and it's like, hey, there's a plane here. It's around there somewhere. And then you just can't find it again.
Yeah.
This discovery, however, still added credibility to the theory that Peter crashed at sea, escaped from the plane somehow, and swam to shore. But again, crashing that violently would surely leave him with more than just a small cut on his leg.
Mm-hmm.
So now people are thinking that if Peter survived that severe wreck, then that probably wasn't his plane. Further, the forensics report after he was found indicated no presence of saltwater or marine organisms anywhere on his body or clothes. But the forensic scientists who examined him did say that if the crash occurred in water and he swam to shore, if his body were laying where it was for, you know, 4 months, it's possible that rainwater and snowmelt and all could have rinsed it away over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So don't discount that completely. In 2004, Royal Navy ships were doing a coastal mapping project, and at about 30 meters of water, that's about 100 feet, near that same area where the divers were, they found a mystery aircraft.
Another one?
Technology's a little better in 2004, so they deployed a remote control underwater camera to go like videotape around it, and their images showed a small plane with one wing still attached. But underwater visibility, again, wasn't the best, so their video's not super clear quality, and they don't have a clear view of the GAVTN registration on the side. They don't know the number that belongs to this plane.
So it's a whole separate plane.
Maybe. So far, we have a plane with no wings and then a plane with one wing.
Well, I don't think it grew another wing, so I'm going to say it's a different plane.
It grew another wing. Like a starfish. If they lose a limb, they grow another one.
So the first one had no wings.
Yeah.
That was found in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then this was, what year was this?
2004.
Okay. And it had one wing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to say it's a separate plane.
Okay. A Royal Navy spokesperson at the time said they thought the plane could be a Cessna, and a spokesperson for Clyde Coast Guard agreed, saying the pictures appear to be that of a Cessna. However, 20 years before, a Piper Aztec plane was also reported as being down in the water around that same area. Its pilot was alive and unhurt, so that's good.
Huh. Interesting.
I think it could be different planes.
I'm going to say it's going to be different because, I mean, unless there was a mistake in the 80s and they thought it was missing both wings, but it really had one wing.
It seems like they investigated it pretty good, though. If they found the fuselage later and looked in the cockpit and tried to open the doors and saw a lobster.
I mean, they're pretty close, so I'm going to think that.
Yeah, I think they would know if it had two wings or not. That's something that's very noticeable about a plane that you find underwater.
Right, exactly. And they saw that it was missing a wheel. They saw the numbers. They realized that the engine was gone.
The plan was to investigate further, but the weather was too bad. Again, it's winter when they're doing this in that area. And divers were expected to go down and see what they could find of the wreckage, but conditions weren't safe for the divers underwater either. And I could not find any follow-ups to this article to see if anybody went down or if anybody has made any further trips to go investigate and dive down and see if they can find these planes.
Let's go.
We should. First, we got to learn to scuba dive.
Yeah. Open water kind of weirds me out.
But... yeah. The theory still stands that Peter likely took off, had some kind of issue where he crashed into the water, escaped from his plane, and swam to shore. But the mystery deepens a little bit more when you realize that a pilot who survived a violent crash like that in freezing temperatures and sleet outside would swim almost a kilometer, it's a little over half a mile, through the sea, in sleet, climb rocks at the shore, cross the road that leads to the hotel, and go up a large hill, and end up there.
Unless he had a head injury.
Why don't you just go follow the road back to the hotel? I don't guess forensics saw any head injuries, though. At least but initially.
You can have, like, a brain injury, and it's not, there's no damage to the outside of the head. I mean, you get a concussion, and that's just, you know, I've had a concussion just from a horse fall, and I had no, I fell off a horse.
I know, but I got the mental image of a horse falling on you.
No, I've had a horse jump on me.
I've only had them step on me.
yeah, jumping, whole other story. Yeah, but my brain was obviously impacted literally against my skull from that.
Yeah.
So he could have, maybe he just had a head injury without the outside trauma to where like it didn't damage his skull or anything. But you hear people like getting head injuries and they just kind of like wander off and don't really know what's happening.
I don't know if something like a concussion would show up 4 months later.
Probably not, because it's in the brain. I don't know even how you diagnose concussions. Most people, I don't even think, go to the hospital because they're not going to be able to do anything except be like, yeah, you have a concussion, or no, you don't.
Don't go to sleep. That's all I know is don't go to sleep if you have a concussion.
No.
Steve Punt interviewed a diver named Richard Greaves, who himself wouldn't even dive in water that cold, he said. And he even uses a dry suit. From my limited knowledge of diving, a dry suit keeps you warmer and drier than a wetsuit.
Makes sense.
Richard said that he found it hard to believe that Peter would swim that far, cross the road, and end up near the top of a hill. He said a friend of his talked to some farmers who lived around the area there, and on that night, they heard a plane fly over their farm really kind of low at about 10 p.m., 30 minutes after Peter's takeoff was, but they didn't think anything about it at the time. So about Peter swimming to shore, Richard said, the more I think about it, the more I doubt it.
Oh, okay.
He also makes a point that I want to know as well is why didn't authorities go and try to lift the plane and find it again? It seems like it would be kind of easy to do because it's a small plane. You could easily lift it. And it seems like now, I mean, this is 2021. We can send some divers down when the weather conditions are good and safe.
Yeah.
And try to find it.
And get it up.
My reckoning is that they probably just don't do it. It might be a costly operation and they just figure they're still not going to know what happened, even if they do raise the plane. So why bother?
Right. Yeah.
It's not like the Martin family disappearance story I did a few episodes ago, where if you find the car, you're probably going to solve a big part of the mystery.
Right, because there were people in there.
Yeah.
Probably.
So even if we did find the plane, I think it's kind of unlikely to know the ultimate reason of why it ended up where it did.
Yeah, I think the big question is just how did he end up where he did?
Yeah. Alan Oregon, who's the author I mentioned earlier, said he actually tried climbing some of the rocks and walking to the hill where he was found, and it took him about 40 minutes to do it, and he only got to the halfway point before he had to turn around. And all I know from this area, again, is Google Maps, but a few people on the Reddit thread I mentioned were just as skeptical as I was about this. One user said that the cliff face, in quotes, cliff face, was probably 5 or 6 feet high in some places, some less, but the terrain is not that rough. It's not like you're rock climbing. You can make it much further than that unless you're trying to take the most difficult route possible, and you'd probably still get there, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. You can walk a mile on flat ground in like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Like absolutely. 40 minutes. Like this is not, it's not bad. And from what I see on Google Earth and Street View images, there are some places where the rocks seem to be a little higher, but they seem kind of easy enough to walk or climb on. It's kind of like rocks you might find in the Pacific Northwest when the tide goes out, you know?
Right. I just wonder why he crossed a road and didn't think, like, I'm just going to walk down the road. Eventually somebody will find me. Like, that's what makes me think head injury. Like, you're not thinking logically. You're making illogical choices.
But could he have made that swim that night in the first place? According to John Golding, who was also interviewed by Steve Punt, a person might last about an hour in water temperatures that cold before they die. For a fast and strong swimmer, they might be able to make it from as far out as they suspected he crashed to the shore in probably about half an hour. So by the time Peter got to the shore, if he did swim, he was probably already halfway to death by hypothermia. John said the first thing a person usually does when they hit extremely cold water is gasp. It's a natural reflex. It causes a lot of people to drown because it's such a shock. Then heat loss will set in rapidly, and eventually you'll fall into a coma and die. But after the heat loss sets in and before coma sets in, your mental processes are going to start to decline really rapidly, and you might not even know what you're doing.
Like crossing a road and climbing a hill.
Exactly. He said if Peter did make that swim, it was possible, but there would be severe side effects. Like when he stood up on the shore, blood would likely rush from his brain and his heart would have to adjust as well. And in super cold water like that, apparently it can be lethal just to be plucked out of water like that. That's why some water rescues, they pull the person out horizontally instead of vertically, because it's easier for the body to not be so shocked.
Oh, that makes sense.
It's kind of like, I've always learned that when you wash a horse that's super hot, you never just blast them with the water hose.
I was literally just thinking that.
Yeah. Roju, are you really?
I was like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, that's how we cool horses off.
But when you want to cool a horse, you can't just take a horse that just got done, you know, exercising or running, it's really hot, and just splash cold water on his chest, because that can be shocking to him. You have to start from the legs and knees and like gradually work your way up and cool him down gradually.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I was thinking, because that's what I learned growing up. You know, after rides, the horses would be hot. You have to go hose them down, and you couldn't just shoot cold water at them because you could shock their heart and kill them. So I always start at the feet, work my way up the legs, do the belly before I always go up to the top. But even then, like, even if it was super hot outside, I would always make sure the water wasn't ice cold. It was always just kind of warm. Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. So we think alike.
We do. So Peter could have been sort of walking around aimlessly because of slow mental processes and shock to his body. That, to me, explains why he crossed the road and didn't follow it back to the hotel. He also could have known what he was doing, but in a dark, moonless, pitch black night, he probably tried to get to a higher spot to get his bearings to see if he could see the light from the hotels.
Yeah, that's that too.
As it often goes with these kinds of stories, conspiracy theories abound. One popular story is that Peter was involved in some kind of criminal activity in Ireland and flew off to meet up with some co-conspirators there. Another is that he flew off in order just to have a better life someplace else.
But then he came back, apparently.
I don't know. I think things seemed to be pretty good with him. It seemed like he loved her, and like he owned a real estate business, and he was piloting and flying around. Like, it seems like, why would he just say, let's escape everything, and then peace out suddenly?
Because sometimes people do that. Sometimes people do that. I don't know.
Two or three witnesses across the sources say that before he took off, the plane was running idle for a longer time than usual before takeoff. I don't know if planes have to warm up when it's cold like cars do. I don't know if he just start them up and go, or if he was waiting for a break in the weather, waiting for Felicity to give him the signal, whatever.
Is he having to like de-ice the plane?
I don't know. That's a good question too. Can you de-ice a Cessna? Seems like you just take a bucket of hot water and there you go.
I don't know. I don't know how it works.
I don't either. I'm sure that's not the way to go. Nobody put buckets of hot water on your planes.
Don't do this. We are not pilots. Please don't do this.
Follow me for more aircraft maintenance tips.
Oh my God. My mom's friend is a pilot who has built his own plane before, and he was probably shaking his head right now listening to me like, no, don't do this.
Ooh, I should get his take on this story.
Yeah, he crashed his plane, actually.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't.
Yes. I mean, he's a good pilot. He built his plane. He's built several planes. He just had a rough landing and ended up crashing his plane.
But there's one theory that he met up with somebody at the other end of the runway. That person got into the plane and Peter went off someplace else. Or Peter picked him up. That guy tossed Peter out mid-flight and crashed by accident and they just never found the other person's body.
How do you pick someone up at the end of a runway?
On Christmas Eve.
You're not.
At 9:30 at night.
You're trying to take off though. Like, are they just like swinging themselves into the plane? Like, it's not, you can stop. Like, but how do you get them on the plane? Like, you're reaching the end of a runway and you're supposed to take off. Like, you're not like, slow down and I'll jump in. Like,
unless they were hiding in the bushes and maybe they meant to meet up because it was dark.
But it's at the end of the runway. How does someone get on at the end of the runway when
he took off when the plane was idling?
Okay. No, yeah. I was thinking at the end of the runway. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. You can't do that. You're trying to gain speed.
Alan Organ, the author, put forth a theory in the Scottish Daily Mail article that Peter didn't fly the plane at all. Around this time, there had been a series of thefts around the area, and he suggests that Peter purposely made a big show of how he was going to fly and land at night, and that the long idle time explains that somebody else was getting into the plane to either dispose of something or go hide something, and Peter just hid in the bushes waiting for that guy to come back. And when he didn't come back, Peter climbed the hill to see if he could see him, and that's where he died of exposure.
Why?
I don't think a guy like Peter is going to let somebody else... You know, he's not going to say, yeah, I can fly and land a plane tonight. What's up? And then let somebody else do it. And then, I don't know. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it seems kind of pointless. I think a lot of people seem to be pointing to the long idle time as being suspicious. Maybe he was just getting ready to go. Maybe he was taking longer to check things.
Yeah.
Like you said, maybe waiting for it to clear up for a second. Maybe waiting for Felicity to place the things at the end of the runway, like,
yeah, the flashlights.
This was something that he hadn't done, and this was something new. So,
I mean, it's not like he needed permission from an aircraft control tower, but still, like, again, do planes have to warm up like cars do? Like, maybe he was just waiting for a good time to take off.
Even if they don't, maybe he wanted to be warmer, maybe because it was so freaking cold, or maybe I don't know. Like, there's a million different, completely innocent reasons why it would idle longer.
Maybe he thought, I gotta go to the bathroom. Crap, I'm just gonna go pee in the bushes real fast.
Maybe he wanted a coat. Maybe he was cold. Was like, oh crap, I forgot my coat.
Yeah, I don't think there was another person there. I think it was by himself. This is where our friend David from Scotland comes in.
Hi, David.
Now, I had asked him if he could possibly locate the books, but had no luck. And so I asked him.
You're gonna say the plane. Oh. Can you just go out and find this plane, for me?
No, I would want to search too, though. I'd be a little jealous, low-key jealous, if somebody else found something like this and I didn't.
Yeah.
I had asked him if there was any local opinions about this story, like what people thought. And he lived farther from the area, so he was unsure. He poked around a little bit online. He got in touch with Brendan Walsh, the current owner of the Glenforsa Hotel.
Whoa.
I know. And Mr. Walsh told him this. This is what he sent me. Probably not what your friend wants to hear. But Peter Gibbs went flying in an aircraft in which he was not current and which was not equipped for the current conditions, i.e. at night and snow showers. He had also spent the evening at the hotel bar and restaurant. Unsurprisingly, he crashed, swam ashore, and died of hypothermia. Anything else was the invention of a local aspiring author and drunk who is no longer with us. Oh. I am a pilot and the current operator of the Glenforsa Airfield and owner of the Glenforsa Hotel. I don't know if Alan Organ was the aspiring author and drunk he referred to, but Alan did have some kind of crazy theories out there. But thank you, David, so much.
Thank you.
It is much appreciated by me getting that little tidbit, and you went above and beyond to help me out. And yes. I also want to share his Instagram with our listeners. It's David Hurd, DAVID.HERD. He's an artist. If y'all want to see some really cool art and beautiful pictures of the Scottish countryside, give him a follow.
I'll follow him. That's interesting to hear a local take on it.
Yeah,
like, look,
it is.
There's nothing really suspicious about this. This is what happened.
And I agree with Mr. Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just an unfortunate accident. I think Peter was having a good time that night. It was a holiday party. Maybe he drank a little much. He was just feeling the vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And the conversation maybe come up and he's like, no, I can do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this. Y'all watch me. I'm going to do this.
Let me do it.
And he just had that kind of personality that he just wanted to challenge himself. He wanted to do what, like, nobody's going to tell him no. And it just ended up tragically for him. I think we'll never know the true reason for the crash. We don't know if it's mechanical failure, pilot error, weather, or maybe a health issue that he had midair. We just don't know. And even if we find the plane, I don't think we're going to know.
Which we could have found the plane.
We could still find the plane. Right.
But no, I agree. I think he probably bailed out, I would say, at a lower distance, which is why he didn't have any broken bones or severe injuries. And then, obviously, I think once he was out was when you had the cartwheeling of the plane.
Yeah.
Probably hit the water and cartwheeled. He was already out, swimming back to shore. I also wonder, because, okay, we know where that one plane was found that they think was his and like the distance it was from the shore. Mm-hmm. My question is, could it have drifted at all further
That's
out?
A good question.
It could have crashed closer.
Yeah.
And then it seems like if he jumped out and didn't have those injuries, it was probably at a lower altitude. Mm-hmm. So it probably didn't, you know, totally nosedive from a high distance. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know anything about plane crashes, but I would think that it didn't all sink right away. So it could have been carried out by the tides before it all just completely sank down. So he could have actually crashed closer to the shore and it wouldn't have taken him as long to swim in.
That's true. Everything I've read online and even all the conspiracy theory speculation comments never brought that up. That's really good. I didn't even think about that. I'm like, you know, the plane could have drifted. It's a small plane. It's lightweight. What if he was, you know, 20 feet from the shore and then, you know, that's it.
I don't really know anything about the tides there, but it's water. It's things are going to drift out. So in that case, it's easier for him to actually swim to the shore, still maybe suffering from slight hypothermia, not thinking straight. You know, your mind kind of does crazy things when you're suffering from hypothermia. Maybe he had a slight head injury and is wandering, doesn't really know what he's doing. Or he's fine, crosses that hill to see if he can get up higher, and then maybe slips and falls, something happens. So.
And I wonder if the wings could have come off the plane or the wheel or something, not because of the crash, but because of being like drifted on the seafloor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a good question, too. Like maybe he went out the big hole in the windshield and maybe that's how he got the cut on his leg.
Yeah, the hole in the windshield is odd.
He could have braced himself for a fall and then maybe just pushed it out or something, or maybe a bird hit it and knocked it out and that caused him to crash. Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know what birds flying around in sleep, but.
Be some, but yeah, that's my I think it's pretty explainable.
Yeah, I do think that is the most likely scenario, but I do wish we could go find the plane at least. I mean, it may not answer any more questions, but it still would be kind of a closure to the story.
Yeah,
just erase the plane, find it, and scrap it or keep a piece of it or something at the hotel. I don't know. I'd create like a little memorial to Peter there.
Yeah, a little memorial. I wouldn't want to scrap it. That, I think, is bad juju.
Scrapping a plane?
Yeah. Well, a plane that somebody crashed in and maybe died.
Well, plus, right now it's
the lobster's home.
Right now it's the home to sea creatures. That lobster has maintained that aircraft for so many years, therefore it is his.
It is now the set of SpongeBob SquarePants.
I also have a listener email that I want to read to you.
Yay.
It comes to us from Andy. He says, hey guys, I just found your podcast and listened to a couple of episodes on a hike today. Good stuff. That's awesome because I like to hike. And if you listen to a couple of our episodes, especially some really long ones, that's a good long hike. And that's what I prefer.
Yes.
That's a good day outside. Good stuff. The second one I listened to was about the Crescent Hotel in Norman Baker. It sounds like you did it last fall, but I just heard it today. So you asked if anyone's been there to give some feedback. I've been there 4 or 5 times and I've done the ghost tour a couple of times.
Cool.
It's a really cool place. If you haven't seen it yet, try to track down an old episode of Ghost Hunters that they did there. There are two scenes that there are only one of two explanations, that the show is totally fake or the ghosts are 100% real.
It's funny. I was actually just watching that show.
Were you?
Before we recorded, which, yes, it's a questionable show, but it's entertaining.
Once it is in the morgue and there's a thermal image of what looks like a Civil War soldier, that's amazing. I happened to run into Jason Hawes from the show in an airport in Rhode Island last fall and we had a chance to talk about it. He swears it's legit and I believe him. My wife and I were there a while ago. After the tour, we were back in our room and my wife said out loud, "If there are any ghosts here, then scream." Immediately, there was a loud scream from outside of our room.
Oh, God.
We looked outside and there was a bachelorette party coming back to the hotel and being loud.
But wild timing.
The timing was unbelievably perfect to the point where it almost had to be more than a coincidence. Who knows? I hope you can get there. It's a really cool place and the whole town is a great place to check out. Looking forward to listening to more of your episodes. Keep up the good work. All the best, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
I think that's awesome. And I also think that, I mean, that timing is too coincidental to be.
Yeah, that's weird. That's odd.
So, I mean, she said scream. She heard a scream.
The ghost is like, okay, I'll make this chick scream.
You didn't say who had to do it, right?
Oh, I want to go to haunted places.
Me too. Maybe you'll buy a haunted house.
Janice had a haunted experience recently.
Really?
Yes. Hi, Janice. She listens to all of our podcasts. She gets so excited on Wednesdays when they come out and texts me. And she's always like, it's podcast day.
Yay.
So, yeah. So in her new house that she just bought, she's had some experiences with smelling things like cherry tobacco. Mm-hmm. Which is an odd smell, not constant, not like it's like a constant smell. It's just kind of comes and goes every once in a while. She was also working one day in the home. She said earlier that morning, like a bowl of berries that she was eating just randomly got knocked off the table. Oh. And then soon after that, later that morning, she sent me a picture of it, this big, heavy, like glass award that she's sitting up on a shelf. She said the whole thing fell.
Oh,
no. The whole award fell hard enough to like dent her floor.
Did it break it?
No, it dented her floor.
Damn.
But she can't figure out what happened to it. She doesn't know how it fell. I said, asked her, did you check is it level? Is like the little shelf level? She said it's level. The thing hasn't moved. It wasn't like balanced on the edge. She has a cat. She's like, the cat's not going to like jump up there. And she would have noticed the cat because it was in the room she was in. She doesn't know how that happened. She's heard movement above her bedroom in the attic in the middle of the night. Her cat will randomly like meow at stuff at night.
Oh.
And then the other night, she said her cat woke up. She's a big black cat. I've shown you a picture.
Yeah.
Looks like Smelly. She's got a big black cat. So her cat came into the bedroom and was like meowing out of control and then ended up walking out of the room. And Janice said she kind of turned over and then on her back, she felt three taps. Like someone like trying to get your attention. Like, hey,
no.
Make your cat stop. Stop. Stop her.
No.
She said it was just like right on her back. Like, hey, stop. Yeah, that was. And it wasn't her cat. Her cat was out of the room.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Maybe the spirit doesn't want her to have whatever award that she won.
I have a theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told her because she's looked into the previous owners. It was an elderly couple. I think both of them have passed away. And there's owners between her and them.
Yeah.
So, but the house was lived in a long time with this elderly couple. My theory is it's the wife recently passed away the last few years, I believe. My theory is she's cleaning. She's cleaning things. She accidentally,
that's nice.
Like, maybe she accidentally knocked the thing down. Maybe she was cleaning the counter and accidentally knocked the bowl down.
Aww.
Maybe it was like her cat's being loud and it's like, hey, stop her. Like, she's being loud. Be quiet. Shut your cat up.
Aww.
Yeah. So
that's
kind of
nice.
Maybe she's just like taking care of the place.
I'd be like, take a break. Come sit with me. Let's watch some Netflix together.
Like, ghosts have to clean. Too.
Yeah, you don't have to clean. Gosh, it's the afterlife. Like, this is your ultimate retirement. Chill. Yeah. Let's have some fun.
So, yep. I'm like, I want to get in there. I was like, set up a recorder in your attic and let it go all night. And then you can listen to it. There I am go. Convinced that weird voicemail that I had come through was something funky.
That was weird.
It gives me chills. And I know there's probably an explanation for it. I'm so used to getting calls that are like, it's spam calls. It's always about a warranty. Right. Extend your warranty. I'm like, shut up. So I expected this call. It was a Kentucky number. I'm like, it's going to be one of those stupid warranty calls.
And I got one of those this morning.
I get them all the time. But then it was this sound. But it was not a warranty voicemail. I sent it to you. I was like, what is this? I fully expected a voice to come through on it. I heard words at one point. It was almost like on a loop. And I heard words. And it said, I'm so sorry. That's what I heard. Sent it to Janice. She said, sounds like windshield wipers going back and forth. But it was a landline number. But it was a landline number.
It is weird. I expected to hear guys down the hill.
Yeah.
Like I was gearing up to hear something creepy.
I expected to hear the Sally House thing. Like that's why I was like, oh God, that's going to happen. This could happen. And I don't believe all EVPs. I think you kind of just hear things in EVPs, but it had that quality. Like it had that, like what you would expect an EVP quality to have. Like,
yeah.
It was weird. It was on a loop and I tried to put it in Audacity and clean it up. I couldn't figure out how to do it, but it just kept creeping me out. I'm like, now it's like coming out of my computer speakers and it's louder and it is freaking me out.
We need to find the technician that worked on the audio for the Astonishing Legends Sally House episode.
Yes, can you clean this up for me,
and
please?
See if they can clean up our audio for us.
Logically, it's probably just some weird spam call that came through, but it wasn't even, at first I thought it was a voice, like recording, and it was just hard to hear, but I'm like, nope, that's a weird, and it's repeating over and over. And to me, it sounded like, I'm so sorry. I'm like, did somebody die that I know and they're sorry? Did they do something?
I hope you enjoyed the story this week.
Did you just say? I hope you.
It's not far from the hotel.
It was like a mix between help and hope.
I said, I hope you enjoyed the story today.
I did enjoy the story. It wasn't what I expected. I didn't expect it. I don't know what I expected. I didn't expect a possible plane crash and disappearance and death. So
yeah,
not at all.
I'm sure you'll have something equally weird for us in 2 weeks.
I think.
Good.
I don't even know at this point. I think I know what I'm doing next. I think I know what I'm doing next. My deep dives might have to take a pause for a little bit. So not that I'm going to shortchange anybody, but like my 3-hour deep dives, like my Delphi and my Salem, might have to take a pause while this house stuff is going on. So
cool. But that's fine, because I may have some deep dives coming up, so I'll just fill in your gaps.
Yes, thank you.
All right, but
they'll still be enjoyable.
Thank you guys for listening. Follow us on Instagram at Darker Side of Life Podcast. We're on Twitter at DSOL Podcast, and our email, if you guys want to send us any stories of your own, is darkersideoflifepodcast@gmail.com. So send us a note if you're feeling froggy.
Give us a shout. Give us a story.
And we will see you guys in 2 weeks.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye. You.